Hi friends, and welcome to the Universal Sisterhood podcast. We're hoping to create a place where women can delve deeper, lift their gaze higher, live freer, laugh louder, smile brighter, and be the authentic woman she was designed to be. Every human heart has been created to be seen, known, and loved. So this is the place where women can share their story. Welcome to episode 96. In today's episode, I chat with Monica Dumit. She is the Director of Public Affairs and Engagement for the Archdiocese of Sydney. She is also a columnist for the Catholic Weekly. We have a frank, honest, and personal conversation about the church, particularly women in the church, and the culture wars that we face. We chat about armoring up and how we do that. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Monica.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Before we dive into the conversation, I'd love for you to tell my listeners who you are and what your life looks like right now.
Of course. So my name is Monica Dumit. I am the Director of Public Affairs and Engagement for the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney. And what does that mean? I guess I'm a policy advisor to Archbishop Anthony Fisher. I get all of the controversial topics. So I was around during the Abuse Royal Commission, the same-sex marriage debate, religious freedom, euthanasia, abortion, you name it, all of the really hot topics that get us all into trouble. I'm there providing the Archbishop with advice on that, assisting in grassroots campaigning, government relations, and everything like that. I can tell you that there's not a day of my work that is the same, and it's certainly never dull. So that's me professionally, but personally, I am a cradle Catholic, Maronite Catholic, beautiful, faithful parents, the youngest of five. I'm single, but I have, 11 amazing nieces and nephews who are my heart outside my chest. And that's me, what my life looks like right now. It's a Saturday morning and I am
pretty cool.
Sitting at my desk, recording this podcast in the middle of writing a Catholic Weekly article as well for next week.
Fantastic. Faith is very personal, and it's very, I don't know about you, but I've take all the criticisms quite personally, and hearing you rattle off all those things that you advise the Archbishop on, how do you take that personally when there's so much aggression, I should say, or maybe animosity towards your belief or our beliefs and our faith?
I guess I can answer in two ways. The first is that in terms of the direct personal attacks, so whether it's, I've received everything from nasty letters in the mail to nasty emails to social media messages and things like that. Mm-hmm. I always take on this practice myself and advise anyone the same, is delete them. Like, double trash the really negative stuff, because on your worst day, you are going to be tempted to revisit it and reread it.
Yeah.
So that's fine if you want to read it, if you want to, take in some of the legitimate criticism, no problem, but then delete it and don't go back to it. So that's the first thing that I will say when it comes to the really personal attacks. And then when it's more about attacks on the church, attacks on the faith, I guess I don't take them personally, but I do really feel a sense of responsibility being on the front line and also being a public face to a lot of these arguments. I mean, when we talk about things like abortion and euthanasia in particular, those losses have a body count, right? Like, there's actually reportable statistics that will tell you how many people have died as a result of those laws going through. And so those types of losses, I guess I feel a real weight to them, and, in a sense, a real personal responsibility in some respects as well. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. Totally. I know for myself, I get so many beautiful, encouraging and uplifting emails and text messages and just messages, Facebook messages and Instagram. But the one that is criticizing me or comes left of field, it sticks. And as you said, in your really low moments, that's exactly where your mind goes. So I will pray for you because that is a really hard place to be. I mean, I'm in my tiny little corner of the internet and you're not. So that just reminds me to pray for you and for all those people that are the face, you know, that are the face of the Catholic Church in a social, in a secular context. So pray to you. I pray for you constantly. I will make sure every day because that is a hard place to be. So I congratulate you. So, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Look, I'm reliant on people's prayers, and one of the most beautiful things that happens being a public face are the people who you've never met before will just walk up to you and say, I just want to tell you I'm praying for you. Mm. I remember being on holidays in the South Coast a number of years ago and was just at Sunday Mass. And then at the end of the Mass, these two people in my pew sort of turned and said, I'm sorry, are you Monica Dumit? And I said that I was. And she said, we pray for you every day. Yeah. And just this really beautiful thing of, you know, the real tangible example of the communion of saints.
Yeah.
Where people are praying for each other and lifting them up to the Lord. It's just wonderful. It's one of the really great graces of my role.
Yeah. That's so encouraging. Wow, how beautiful. So you haven't always been in journalism. Can we backtrack a little bit and see where did Monica Dumit begin?
So I guess this path in my life probably began in the middle of high school. I was about 15 or something like that. And I sort of had this realization that I was that really annoying kid at school who never had to study for anything and always came at the top of the class and everything like
you're
that.
You're annoying.
I was that girl you hated.
But grew to love tenderly.
But it gave me this real sense that whatever the academic gifts that I hadn't worked for. They were a gift and a grace. And even before I was really serious about my faith, I sort of understood that I had to use the gifts that I had for the service of others in some respect. So at first that led me into law. It sounds a little bit funny now, but I honestly thought that as a lawyer I would be able to help a lot of people and change the world. But I started off in tobacco litigation for a couple of years and then spent most of my legal career, about 10 years, in corporate law, mergers and acquisitions, so buying and selling companies. Mainly I was based here in Sydney, but I lived in London for a little while, still with the idea that I was being prepared for something and for some type of service to the church. But I loved the law. I loved being a lawyer. It was a really wonderful and exciting life. But then I was living in London, and I remember receiving an email here from somebody who was working for the Archdiocese of Sydney in the communications team. And the email began with, you know, Dear Monica, we think that you should quit your job, move back to Sydney from London, and work full-time here for the Archdiocese in communications. Below you will find a list of your objections and our responses to those objections. So once you've been through that, give us a call and tell us when you're ready to come across. I don't remember what was on the list, but I remember the very first one was, I'm a lawyer and I know nothing about media or communications. To which they responded, we can teach you media and comms. We can't teach you a love for the church, and that's really what we're looking for. And so I prayed about it and quit my job and moved back to Sydney and started working for the Archdiocese now almost 10 years ago. And it was certainly a wild ride. I came right at the beginning of the Royal Commission. Wow. And then that finished and the marriage campaign started. So I first started in research at the marriage campaign and then moved on into direct communications and public spokesperson work and things like that. After that finished, it included relocating to Canberra for a few months. And after that finished, I was really excited about the political side. I thought that that was really where I belonged and really where I could serve the best. And so I sort of had a conversation with the communications director and said, look, I've really enjoyed my time at the Archdiocese, but I think I'm going to pursue politics full time. I think that's where I belong. And God bless him, Archbishop Fisher intervened and suggested that maybe I didn't discern that as well as I could have. And so created this particular role for me that I'm in now, which is a mix, not only of a little bit of communications, but more policy and campaigning and government relations and things like that. So to keep me at the Archdiocese basically gave me free rein to do everything that I love. And I'm so grateful that he took a chance on me. It's just been an amazing ride.
I'm so grateful.
I'll always be grateful.
I'm sure most of the Catholic community in Sydney are grateful that you are there.
That's so kind. And look, I think we'll get onto this later in the podcast, but that's why for me, when we have sort of conversations about the role of women in the church, it's I can only speak from my experience, which is just this absolute gift and an opportunity that I was given by our Archbishop, which was just amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Women are such valuable members of the body of Christ, of our church, and that criticism that we are overlooked baffles me, because I am around the church every day, and I have never once, and I know that's not everybody's experience, but I've never once felt less than or insignificant. Anyway, let's dive into what sparked my interest in an article that I read in the Sydney Morning Herald a few months ago. I only look online. I don't have the paper version, but the first picture that popped up on my phone was sick of it. Catholic women vent frustration over sex, power and abuse. And I thought, oh, here we go. This will be interesting. This will be very measured. This would be a really, accurate article. Not. The first line stated, the largest study of Catholic women in the church's 2,000-year history has found that they are hungry for reform. And then it goes on to say that Australian research has led the global study, and 84% of women want reform in the church. Two-thirds wanted radical reform. And I thought, hang on a minute. I work for the Catholic Women's Network in Sydney, and surely they would have asked me for my opinion. So I thought, I've really stuffed up here. I've missed an email. So I went back through all my emails. No, they hadn't sent me one. So I thought, surely it can't be that extensive. Were you asked to join in the survey? Because I wasn't.
Well, I saw it advertised on social media. Okay. And so I clicked on the link, and I was one of the participants. Uh-huh. So
Did you want radical reform?
Well, I guess it depends on what radical reform means, right? Like, I think, you know, if we're talking about conversion, then I'm all for reforming the way of conversion and purification and conformity, closer to Christ. But one of the things that really, I don't want to say surprised me, because unfortunately it didn't surprise me about the questions, but they were all rooted in sex, power, and changing in church teaching on issues of around governance, life, and sort of sexual morality. So,
and the priesthood.
Women priesthood as well, right? Of course. You've got to get all of the greatest hits in there. But there was nothing in there about, family life, religious life, prayer life. And nothing in it about the wonderful work you do with the Beloved Retreats and everything like that. It sort of seems to narrow the concerns of women around really around leadership and governance and issues of sexuality. And I know they described it as the biggest survey of Catholic women in history, and numerically that might be true. I'm not sure. I've got no reason to doubt the claim that they make, but numerically it might have been a large survey, but in terms of the issues it traversed, it was probably one of the most narrow things I've ever seen. You would know, Jess, I know, I'm sure all of the listeners know, that being a Catholic woman involves so much more than sex and power. And to be honest, that's, you know, a very minuscule part of what it means to be a Catholic woman. First and foremost and fundamentally, it's my relationship with Christ through the church, access and participation in the sacraments, you know, family life, the way we live out our vocations, our state, our various states in life, all of those types of things. So to sort of narrow the questions to that and try and extrapolate the data from focusing on those issues, I think might have been a bit misleading. I'm not doubting the goodwill of the people who conducted the survey, and certainly I've been in direct contact with one of them who was quite generous in her communication with me, but I don't like this reductionist view of Catholic womanhood, the idea that we're all sort of hungry for power, yeah, and influence and all of those types of things.
But you are a beautiful example. You didn't go looking for power. You were actually sought out by the Archbishop, seek you out. Like, he could see your gifts above any other man and asked you to fulfill that role. I see that over and over and over again in the church. It's such a beautiful thing to see. So it really upsets me when I read these things that, you know, just a blanket statement for the secular world to, you know, roll their eyes again. It's sad, but as you say, we need to be women of hope, right?
Absolutely.
How do we do that?
Well, look, I think there are many great reasons to hope. We can see all of the, all of the various sort of social pressures on the church, but one of the things that always reminds me of is that the people who are currently involved and active in the church aren't here because they think it's going to be fun or easy, right? This is now is an intentional choice for those who are committed to the church, right? You're in the trenches with people who really want to be there out of love of God and love of others. I see this most especially in our clergy, and particularly our young clergy. So anyone who was ordained or entered seminary in the last 10 years has done it in the shadow of the Royal Commission, right? Mm. I think the Royal Commission was announced at the end of 2012. And so, you know, all of us will remember, or most of us will remember, the scandal and the, you know, public exposure of the horrible crimes of the past, but also in that some of the, I guess, disproportionate criticism and attention laid against the church. And these guys knew that they were seeking ordination and sort of pursuing a vocation to the priesthood, knowing that for the rest of their lives they would be trying to make up for the wrongs of the past, and demonstrate it, you know, a hopeful and fatherly face of the church. And they knew it, and they put face to marble anyway.
Yeah.
And they're in the trenches. And so I think if they've committed for life, then I can commit for at least one more day and see how we go. And one of the greatest gifts, and possibly the thing I love most about my job, is the ability to work alongside our clergy. So many good, wonderful, holy men who just give of themselves overabundantly every day. And that's then also true. Seeing, you know, wonderful lay people doing the same. And so I'm full of hope because I get to see up close how many good people are involved in the church at the moment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The one thing that has really been such a consolation to me is seeing these young friends coming through, and it just shows you that God uses all things, even the most horrific things, to bring good from. And these young, holy, faithful, encouraging young seminarians is just so hopeful to me. And I'm sure the fruits are going to be incredibly bountiful. It's really, really beautiful.
Absolutely. The other aspect of that is I'm also quite inspired by the older guys, right, who have been at this for 40 or 50 years and still get up every day, you know, and battle on. We talked about the sort of the negative mail that I get from time to time, but amongst my favorites are, you know, I'll get a letter and it's written in the beautiful sort of cursive handwriting that's long gone. Yeah. And it'll be from an elderly priest somewhere in a nursing home who's writing to me to give me some encouragement or some ideas for the battle, or, you know, have you thought about this aspect of human rights or something like that? And I'll always reply to these priests and just ask them to pray for me that, you know, when I'm their age, I'm still fighting and I'm still interested in that. That's, so, you know, as much hope as I get from the young guys, I also get such great hope and inspiration from those who have been on the battle lines and on the front lines for longer than I've been alive, and still care and still give their heart to it every day.
That's so gorgeous. And that there again is the communion of saints, you know, that lifting each other up, no matter where you are on your journey, just reach out, because the young ones draw such inspiration and wisdom from the older clergy and older people in the church. And the older ones realize that the battle that they've fought their whole life was worthwhile, you know, that it meant something to somebody, and it encouraged somebody. So it's both and, right? It's beautiful. I love it. Can we talk about your article that you wrote in the Catholic Weekly? Now, I jumped into it and then jumped straight back out of it. But it was the article you wrote in the Catholic Weekly about a radio program that advertised, there was a competition where you could marry yourself. And I think that really says something about our culture. I loved the spin you took on it, because initially I thought, what, here we are, another wokeism, people marrying themselves, you know, or marrying their animals and things like that. But as I read it, I realized, oh, hang on a minute. No, this is not where she's going. I would love for you to speak into that a little bit for us, if that's okay.
Sure. So one of our most popular radio stations ran a competition for women to write in for what they were calling a wedding for one. So the ability to, if you were selected, you would win, I think, a wedding dress, a ring, and be part of a wedding reception held at, what, you know, a beautiful Sydney venue. And you'd walk down the aisle either on your own or accompanied by, you know, some were accompanied by their dads, others by their children, walk down and took vows to yourself. And in listening to the program, and particularly in the vows that the women wrote to themselves, you could see a deep longing within them. So they were talking about, they vowed to love themselves, to respect themselves, to put themselves first, to care for themselves, and things like that. Like this idea that there's obviously within them a desire for love and for respect, and I guess a public celebration of who they are. All of these women didn't have the same story. Some had never been married. Some were married and divorced. There was even a grandmother amongst them. But all of them had this yearning for some type of public affirmation or validation of who they were. which I kind of found really sad and actually quite disappointing that that legitimate and good desire was exploited by a radio program just for just for fun and in the process kind of, I guess, made a bit of a mockery of marriage as well. But I did look, I did feel for these women. I think I mentioned at the beginning of this, I'm 41, I'm single. And so I get the idea that, you know, you get to a certain age in your life where you think, well, okay, maybe, you know, I'm not going to find true love and, you know, where's my party? Where's my celebration? Where's my affirmation of who I am? So I did look, I felt bad for these women. I think it was definitely the wrong way to go about it. I think that there's more that we can do to affirm not only women, but men as well in who they are and almost, you know, say, it, you know, your state in life doesn't really matter. What matters is your ability to love and be loved by others, your ability to give of yourself and to receive. And you can do that whatever your state in life is. I always say for single Catholics, we don't get off the hook in sort of backing vocations, that we need to be the best, you know, friend, auntie, whoever, to married couples within our lives who are doing it tough. And one of my friends described it as being the release valve for marriages around us. You know, be good friends with priests and religious and others, back a vocational culture, because all vocations are under attack at the moment. And I think that those of us enduring more single years than we planned or wanted should really be at the forefront of assisting those others living out their vocations as well.
I think that you touched on it, but that radio station was really tapping into that idea or that yearning, that deep, deep longing to be seen, known and loved, and they were exploiting it. But it really shows that we all desire that, each and every one. You can't escape that deep longing, and it highlights the fact that they're not receiving that because they don't know that they are seen, known and loved by God. Like it reflects our secular society's absence of God. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Without finding your identity in Christ and knowing the personal love of God, like, it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult with God, impossible without him. So I think that's true. I think it also speaks not only to a rejection of God, or, you know, at least a lack of, you know, relationship with him in broader society, but also a diminishing of a lot of the institutions that used to give us our identity. So families are more fragmented, with more people living alone, with people not attending churches. That community that provided people with a sense of identity also has sort of faded away. We seem to be, with the growth of, I guess, anti-institutionalism, we also then seem to be struggling to find our identity, because all of the things we used to find our identity in, particularly family, faith and community, being so dispersed. And so people are looking for a replacement for that and finding it wherever they can, including in marrying themselves.
Yeah. And I'm now going on a tangent here, but also, as Anzac Day is approaching, that is becoming, like, I can't tell you how much more popular it has become in secular. Like, our little village here closes the streets, and all these people get up at the crack of dawn for the dawn service, and you think that they're hungry to be part of something. And not that Anzac Day is a bad thing to be part of. It's a wonderful thing to be part of. But you think this increase in a desire or an increase in showing your, getting behind Anzac Day and, you know, everything that it entails, shows this deep longing to be part of a community. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And also, again, finding your identity in something and Yeah, that's what I think. One of the big things. I mean, also the extraordinary sacrifice and service of our Anzacs, but yeah, the idea of holding onto something that helps define you and who you are, I think, is really important. And I guess that's also why we see the on the flip side, we see the growth of what they call identity politics. So the idea that people will try to coalesce around a particular group based on a particular identity simply to feel that belonging and that connection.
Can we talk a little bit about culture wars and what are they? Just to give people a little, because I know especially women feel that they are fighting something and they're not quite sure what. But I think that would be a really good place to begin this kind of understanding, is if you could give us a mini lesson on, is there a culture war and what are we fighting and kind of how do we armor up, or should we armor up? Could we go into that?
Yeah, sure. What I guess one of the things I always like to say, that a little bit of trivia when I start talking about the culture wars, is that when we talk about the culture wars today, we sort of think about it as competing worldviews, particularly on social issues, sort of butting up against each other. But the original phrase culture wars actually comes from about 150 years ago. I'm going to maybe get this wrong. I think it was sort of the Prussian government enacted a number of laws, I think something like 22 laws, that were specifically aimed first at Christianity in general, and then as the Catholic Church began to publicly resist, laws that directly targeted the Catholic Church, not only in terms of its structures, but also into the internal affairs of the church. And so it's kind of funny that the beginning of the culture wars and our understanding of what they are was actually an attack on the Catholic Church. And so we shouldn't be surprised that 150 years later we're still feeling those effects. But look, I guess, broadly speaking, when we talk about the culture wars, it's the idea of this drift of society away from faith, mm-hmm. and then the rejection of sort of what we would call plurality. So the idea of different faiths and no faiths living alongside each other in a bit of harmony. I think how we experience the culture wars, particularly here in Australia, is the idea that people would like to see faith pushed to the fringes of society, definitely out of the public square, and the idea that you're allowed to go into your church or synagogue and mosque and pray there. Maybe you're not allowed to say all of the things in there that are contrary to modern day values, but that's where religion and faith should be contained, and that any attempt to move out of the church into whether it's politics, leadership of organizations, education, health, all of that should be religion free. And we see that whether it's politicians of faith being completely completely targeted, people like Andrew Thorburn, who was running a football club and simply because he attended a church that had traditional teachings on life and marriage, ended up losing his job. The consistent targeting of religious education and faith-based schools, the push to force Catholic hospitals and aged care facilities to allow abortion and euthanasia and other things like that. So the idea that if you want to be in the public sphere at all, you have to remove religion from that, which is not the makings of a good society, because we can't compartmentalize faith. Still the majority of Australians are people of faith. Some 60% of people identify with their religion, and the idea that 60% need to keep their mouths closed about their faith and only practice it on, you know, an hour or two a week, just just misunderstands the nature of what faith is.
Mm-hmm. And the danger of what it would do to society.
Absolutely. I mean, if we were to remove religious faith and the contributions made to society based on people's religious faith, it would collapse. Mm. I mean, there's hospitals, sort of this...
schools, universities, what else?
This cognitive dissonance, this idea that people think, oh, well, if people put their faith aside, society will continue fine. No. Yeah. The reason we have hospital systems and school systems and things like that is because people were inspired by their faith towards the service of others. Mm-hmm. Statistics will show you, you know, people of faith are, you know, give more often to charity, whether it's their time, their talents, their treasure, that there's something about being a person of faith that inspires you to service, and the idea that you can just delete that from history and think that society will run the same is a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
But I guess too, for us now in 2023 in Australia, what does that mean in terms of how do we fight back, or how do we preserve the role of faith? And look, not everyone is called to a role like mine, which is quite a public role. And I dare say no one is called to have these arguments on social media. But we need to be creative. So how do we do it? We're more intentional about family life, about living and preaching the gospel with the witness of our lives. Let's be more intentional about who our kids are mixing with. Let's be more creative about, you know, parish groups on the weekends or during school holidays or things like that. Let's try to find a way to ensure we are preaching the gospel always, but mainly at this point through the witness of our lives. So we insulate ourselves against whatever laws will still come in this iteration of the culture wars. I think really the most important thing to know is that we all have our role to play. One of the, I guess, sad things, but also lovely things I hear whenever I go and give talks to people about religious freedom or the culture wars or anything like that, I'll always get sort of mums and grandmothers put their hand up and say, look, you know, I don't really know how to fight this battle, and I'm just a mum or I'm just a grandma, and there's nothing that I can do. And I always sort of smile at the comment because I know it's coming. And the thing is that mums and grandmas can do way much more than pretty much anybody else, right? Like, you're the ones who get to form your families in faith, in love of others or anything like that, more than anybody else. You are the biggest influence on their life. I'll often say to these mums and grandmas that you don't get to see the fruits of your labors, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to get to see the kind word that your child says to another person, or the service that they do another based on your example. You're never going to get to see that. You just have to entrust it to the Lord. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mums can do anything. The influence they hold, I always say, like, mums are the black ops of the Catholic Church. They are really the CIA, the special ops. They are planted everywhere, in every household, in every parish. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, because often of their humility fly under the radar, but they're the ones who really get to have the influence. Mums are the special ops. And I think that that's wonderful. And we know, right, the culture of death is just self-defeating because it's sterile.
Yeah.
The culture of life will win, right, because we will outlive, outbreed, outlove, outpray, outserve, outsmart, outvocation everybody else, right? And that's largely down to women.
Yeah.
I think there's great reason to hope and just to trust that where God has put you, that's your sphere of influence, and that's you're part of the battlefield. You're part of the garden that you're tending, and working together and praying for each other and lifting each other up. We can do great things.
That's so beautiful. I love that idea of the black op, like we're the sleeper cells. I've never felt more like a sleeper cell than in COVID when we had Easter. We had the domestic church. Everyone had to go back indoors. And it was, for me personally, the most fruitful Easter I've ever had. That Holy Week where, you know, you weren't at Mass, you didn't go to any of the services, it was all online. That rallying of women on social media, in my sphere of influence, of, you know, putting palm leaves on your door, having an altar in your home, you know, bringing your family together in front of Our Lady. Like, for me, that was so special and really highlighted to me the fact that we are the special ops, you know. It's amazing how much influence you do have over your family if you're intentional about it, if you realize. So I think it is supporting those women, which is paramount, and you're doing such a good job at it. So I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you. But this brings us back to where we began in this podcast, right? The idea that we can have hope because this is now an intentional choice for Catholics, right? This isn't something that you just catch from the culture and sort of you can be it, you know, you can go along being a cultural Catholic. There's really no such thing.
Yeah,
you actually have to intentionally choose it and intentionally work for it, first and foremost in your own heart, but then in your home and amongst your family. And in terms of the culture wars, I think COVID is a really good example, because there we had quite physical limitations on the practice of faith. But say if our laws change and to further restrict religious freedom in a way that, I guess by analogy, you're back to COVID situation where the real place of prayer has to be your home and your family, we've already proven that we can do it. Mm. We've already proven that we can do it. There's nothing that the law can do to the church that will stop the faith being passed on. They can try, but we've been here for 2,000 years and Christ promised that he'd be with us until the end of the age, right? So, look, you know what? Do your best. Do your worst, whatever.
He'll fill in the gaps. He won't
leave. He'll fill in the gaps. Yeah. And the other thing is that a good friend of mine once said, and it always reminds me, is that God intentionally put us in this period in history. Yeah. He could have created you. He could have created me in any other time, but he's given us this period of history, this period of time in Australia, and so he must have a reason for us to be here now. I think Jesse and I were talking offline a little bit about World Youth Day, and obviously World Youth Day 2023 is coming up, and my first experience was in 08. The people who I met through that process in the lead up to World Youth Day 2008 and in the week itself still remain some of my closest friends, and looking at where they all are now, in different ways, they're serving the church and serving the mission, whether they're, you know, teachers or doctors or priests or religious or raising families or policy advisors or anything like that. And so God uses those gathering points to then equip us for mission in the future of the church as well.
Your upper rooms.
Absolutely, absolutely.
How beautiful.
And he does it throughout history,
yeah,
in every generation, right? Yeah. Like, and just, I know you see it. I see it so close up. It's wonderful and it's exciting. And it's a challenge. Does it have its challenges? Of course. But my goodness, there are some good people in that upper room, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. And that upper room is moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is really beautiful to see. So that is hope. And the hope also is he fills in the gaps. You don't have to get it right and you don't have to do it all. Just do your, just begin. Because he keeps feeding and fueling and blowing where he wills. And you just have to surrender and go, And that's exactly what you've done, and look what you're doing. So I am so grateful for you, Monica.
Thank you, God, right? Like, yeah. I love it. I love it. I wouldn't change anything for the world.
How good. Before we end, Monica, I always ask my guests something that has brought them joy this week. So is there something that has brought you joy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just kind of alluded to it. So last night I was at a fundraiser for a World Youth Day group going off to World Youth Day in Lisbon. And one of the members of the group, and the reason I was at the fundraiser, is because my eldest nephew is 17 and he's off to World Youth Day in a couple of months. And so I went to this fundraiser last night and I got to see him with all of his friends and hear some of his friends get up and speak about how much they were looking forward to World Youth Day, about the impact that their youth group has had on their life and everything like that, and just watching them engage with each other. And I thought back to the friends I met at my first World Youth Day and how they've carried me really through the last 15 years and more, and how, you know, we've built each other up and walked together in faith. And now I look at my young nephew and I can see all of that ahead of him, and was so impressed by the friends he's got around him. And it just gave me such joy, not only gratitude for the last couple of decades of my life, but also in seeing it, like we were just saying, that the God continues to renew this in every generation, and to really see it in the next generation, just thoroughly, thoroughly joyful.
How beautiful. Well, mine is kind of similar. I have a retreat coming up in Toowoomba, Queensland, and just this whole conversation, we launched it last night, so it is now open for bookings. But just to be intentional about your faith journey, and also who you surround yourself with, as you said, these are places where you can find real faith-filled friendships, and they will carry you, because we need each other. As we were talking about the priests, they need to see it. We are the body of Christ. We can't function properly without each other. And these places are where you will find friendships that will carry you. And I, for one, am so grateful for them in my life. And I'm sure you are in yours as well. So I'll put all the links in the show notes.
Pure grace. Well, this has been great.
Yeah, it's been awesome. So thank you so much. Go and enjoy your lem sip tea. I know you've got a sore throat. Thank you. I'm very grateful, and continue doing the wonderful work that you're doing, because you're incredible. And I encourage everybody who hears this podcast to say a prayer for Monica, because she does deal with a lot. So thank you.
Thanks so much. Love you lots.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. I'm really grateful that you are here. If you enjoyed it, consider sharing it with a friend. Hop on over to my Instagram page, universalsisterhood_, and you can see musings, thoughts, pictures, and just ideas that I have in my head. You can also follow me on the private Facebook group. Just ask for an invitation and I will let you in. Have a great rest of your week. Bye.